Hi, it's Fraser here. And before we get into the Spiked podcast, I just wanted to tell you a bit about a very special film Spiked has out this month. It's called Black Guns Matter, and it focuses on Madge Turay, a Second Amendment activist who's fighting against what he sees as the racist policies of gun control. Check it out on Spiked. Check it out on YouTube. It really is a must watch. Now, on with the show. Hello and welcome to the Spiked podcast. I'm Fraser Myers, and with me this week we have Spiked's deputy editor Tom Slater.
Hello.
And Spiked columnist Ella Whelan.
Hi.
Coming up on the show, Trump's UK visit, feminist outrage, and transphobia in the Hooniverse.
And then I heard that there were protests. I said, where are the protests? I don't see any protests. I did see a small protest today when I came.
Some of the things Donald Trump has done over the last 2-3 years, Londoners find abhorrent and offensive.
I'm not saying that he shouldn't come. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have business meetings. I'm not saying we shouldn't talk to him. But the things I want to say to President Trump, I probably shouldn't say in front of a mess.
Donald Trump was in the UK this week and had barely landed before causing controversy. Tweeting from Air Force One, Trump called the London Mayor Sadiq Khan a stone-cold loser. This was in response to an Observer piece by Khan, which likened Trump to the European dictators of the 1930s and 40s. A day later, crowds descended on London to protest against Trump's so-called fascism. Tom, why does Trump get under people's skin so much?
This is something I've been trying to kind of think about this week, because it's precisely that question which there's not been a sufficient answer to yet. Why is it that whenever Donald Trump pops up, whenever he comes to London, he seems to elicit this kind of outsized, ridiculous response from everyone, from the mayor of London through to the leadership of the Labour Party, through to the kind of yummy mummies and people who look like they got lost on the way back from Glastonbury turning out into the streets for this kind of carnival of resistance? What is it about him that actually really upsets them so much? It seems obvious, and you ask them and they'll tell you that he is this kind of proto-Nazi, xenophobe, misogynist, etc. But when you really kind of dig down into the question of policies, we've been making this argument, a lot of people have been making this argument for a long time. Say if you're concerned about the issue of immigration, as we all know, and we've known for years, Obama deported somewhere in the region of 3 million people, far more people than any of his predecessors, used tear gas against people at the border. If you're really that concerned with that issue, why was there never any kind of Obama baby balloon at any point? So it's definitely not that. And the thing I keep coming back to, which is something I wrote on Spiked about a month ago when the state visit was finally given a firm date, was part of this at least has to be about just British snobbery. Now, you make that argument and people think you're talking about Trump as if he's some sort of sort of the earth bootstrapper. Of course, he inherited all of his wealth. He lives an incredibly lavish lifestyle. All of that is completely true. But that's not necessarily just how the class system works, of course. And the one person I quoted was George Orwell from Road to Wigan Pier, where he talks about being brought up as a child of the lower upper middle class and being an odious little snob and being brought up to loathe as much the people below you who weren't gentlemen, but also the people above you who were hoggishly rich and came into money too soon. And I can't help but feel that that's part of this. He kind of just is crass, is offensive. So much of this is about what he is rather than actually what he does. And that to me has got to be at least part of the reason why there is this ridiculous, over the top, very ostentatious display of anger towards him when he can go to Paris and Berlin and get nowhere near this kind of response.
Ella?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much just become a way to signal that you are a good and decent person by saying something outrageous about Trump. I think one of the most shocking examples of that was the reaction from Emily Thornberry in relation to the Trump state visit. I mean, not least, first of all, because she branded him a sexual predator, among other things, and said that if she was 30 years younger, she wouldn't want to be alone with him. And essentially just rolled off all these insults, and not in a way that was really politically meaningful, but just to say that he's a nasty guy and I'm a nice person and look how good I am. It's also very interesting in relation to the way that the state visit has been treated, because, I mean, I find it very difficult to get excited by a state visit. I think most people do, unless you're kind of a diehard monarchist or a massive fan of Trump. It's just sort of like the kind of pomp and the grandeur of it. It's all really boring. But it's been given so much political weight in relation to the fact that you've got people like Emily Thornberry and others in the Labour Party talking about how much, you know, this is an honour that we should not extend to Trump. And it's terrible that the Queen has to see him, and we should, you know, protect the Queen. And Emily Thornberry said, the things that I have to say to Trump, I couldn't possibly say in front of the Queen. And you just think, yuck. It's just really kind of never mind what it says about Trump and our views on him, the kind of forelock tugging, disgusting nature of some of our own political establishment in relation to the state visit and the use and abuse of Trump as this means to just virtue signal. It kind of leaves you feeling a bit dirty watching all of it. You just think, oh, I'm so glad it's over.
I think one of the very fair criticisms of Trump is that he practices this kind of Twitter diplomacy that, you know, he shoots from the hip, and this can have, you know, quite strange effects on visiting countries. But I mean, surely the same is true of people like Emily Thornberry, where basically, why is she saying what she's saying? Why is she calling Donald Trump a racist and a sexual predator? It's not for some overarching foreign policy goal. It's for the likes and the retweets on Twitter. It's for, you know, it's to impress a certain section of society. And so you have this really, you know, bizarre thing where now, you know, Jeremy Corbyn was shocked that he wasn't granted a meeting with Trump, even though he spoke at the anti-Trump protest. And Emily Thornberry was shocked that she's now had to cancel her trip to America because now they don't want to meet with her. I mean, these people want to be, you know, world leaders, and Emily Thornberry wants to be the foreign secretary. You know, she could be potentially a worse foreign secretary than Boris Johnson, which isn't even, you know, which is an unthinkable thing. It's completely bizarre that they have absolutely no thought as to, you know, what they're communicating and what effect that might have. It's just all about the retweets.
Also, it's just largely empty. I mean, in relation to lots of people were talking about the fact that we should oppose Trump because of the restrictive abortion laws and bills that have been passed or in the process of being passed in America, and the kind of his status as a very much a pro-life supporter. Well, you know, Sadiq Khan putting out a video about, you know, how we should oppose him because of these views. Well, I mean, you don't have to go to Alabama, as we've said previously on this podcast, to find really restrictive abortion laws. It's already happening in this country and in Northern Ireland. So in terms of the kind of emptiness of those kind of political statements, it looks very much like our members of our political class are being very profound and, you know, very principled, standing up to him. But actually, they do a lot of the similar things at home.
I thought Sadiq Khan was interesting as well. And this isn't an original point, but he really is the kind of London's middle class Trump. Like in this whole trip, he took it entirely out of the Trump playbook. Of course, him and Trump have this long running feud, Twitter beef. It's gone on for a very long time. But, you know, the only time that Sadiq Khan has really been in the news that much over the past year has been over him really messing stuff up or dropping the ball. It's been about spiraling knife crime. And again, straight out of the Trump playbook, things are going really bad domestically. You start some sort of over-the-top spat and it completely distracts attention and it rallies your base. That's exactly what he did in this situation. And the fact that people can't see that, I think, is hilarious.
And, of course, you know, Sadiq Khan basically suggested that Trump was a fascist, or, you know, likening him to the dictators of the 30s and 40s. Tom, do you want to talk to us a bit about that, the way that anti-fascism has become degraded?
And I think we saw that most clearly, really, in that viral clip, which has now done the rounds, of a British Londoner Trump supporter being kind of surrounded by all this group of protesters who are just shouting Nazi scum in his face over and over again. It then kind of escalates. Someone throws a milkshake. Everyone knows what that means now. And then a kind of sort of scuffle ensues. And I think that really just showed how degraded anti-fascism has become. And also how, given the Sadiq Khan thing, how mainstream it is to just completely abuse and degrade this incredibly mainstream term. It's worth pointing out the gentleman in question, if you look at the longer video, there is a point in which he's calling some of the protesters, a guy, as it so happens, a white guy in dreadlocks, a very kind of at central casting. He's calling them a fascist as well. But we've got to recognise how, you know, where that kind of dynamic comes from, where throwing around the F word comes from. And it is coming from everyone from, you know, supposed radical leftists and anti-fascists right up to the kind of liberal left. It's become incredibly mainstream. And I think on the one hand, it's incredibly dangerous insofar as you do rob that word of its historical significance. Whatever Trump is, he's not a Nazi, and it's ridiculous to throw that kind of term around. You end up really making a mockery of and kind of relativizing the horrors of Nazism and fascism. But at the same time, it's so utterly infantile. That's the other thing about it. You know, the anti-fascism has become the butt of jokes, and that's a really sad thing. Very proud history, you know, the international volunteers in the Spanish Civil War, people, you know, clearing out the East End of London of NF types in the 70s and 80s. It is now associated with kind of scrawny students shouting at Jacob Rees-Mogg and these people down on Whitehall just screaming Nazi hysterically at someone who happens to be wearing a MAGA hat. And I think that's something which is incredibly depressing, but at this point, something of reputation which is increasingly, you know, fairly earned.
And one of the other dangers, of course, from the Trump visit, if you're reading the mainstream press, is not only will there be the rising tide of fascism, but also our green and pleasant land could be flooded with chlorinated chicken. This is one of the fears of a US-UK trade deal. I don't know if anyone has any thoughts on this particular scare.
Well, I mean, it's part of the, you know, we talk about this a lot on this podcast, it's part of the Brexit scaremongering, but I think also it is part of what Tom was talking about, the kind of anti-American snobbery, which, you know, a lot of the commentating about the Trump visit has been soaked in this idea that the Americans are these sort of crazy consumers who just don't have any respect for the planet or for standards, and they're disgusting, they eat chlorinated chicken, you know, how could we bear to have that over here? I mean, as if our own sort of way of processing food is sort of like some kind of, people have this vision that is like clean eating and miraculous, you know, creating food, killing animals is a dirty business. And if it works in the way that Americans do it, and it seems to do, then what's the problem? But I think you always have to look behind the like scientific facts of this, which people are still debating whether or not this is a problem or not. What it really is, it's a kind of aversion to both Brexit and just the kind of the very old snobbery against Americans, which is sort of never gets challenged.
And even on the facts, I mean, the chlorinated chicken thing, it's Chris Snowden, friend of the show, also on our Last Orders podcast, tweeted this, that the chlorinated chicken thing has become to remain what bendy bananas was to leavers. You know, this kind of completely confected, made up issue, which is just routinely trotted out. And the only thing it really proves is how, you know, ignorant these people are whenever they make this argument. The European Union's own food standards authority said it was completely fine to eat, and they ruled that in 2005. The reason it's not allowed into the EU is because of protectionism, you know. Yeah. And even in this country, we wash, you know, you pick up a salad bag from a supermarket, that's washed in chlorine. So it's completely confected. It definitely does express this kind of anti-Americanism. But again, I think it just shows that given how much this has been repeated by everyone from, you know, Remain campaigners who were showing up in Trafalgar Square dressed as chickens, through to Jeremy Corbyn pumping it out as, again, this kind of anti-American, anti-capitalist message, just, you know, how much they are reliant on kind of spin and ludicrous stories as much as they accuse our side of the aisle of being.
Well, exactly. And the other great fear, of course, is that the NHS, our beloved National Health Service, will be put on the table in any trade deal. And I've, you know, I tried to sort of debunk this this week in Spiked. And, you know, it's just this ridiculous assertion that via a trade deal, somehow, you know, the big bad Donald Trump is going to force the privatization of the National Health Service. But of course, anyone who's been following the National Health Service for over the last 10, 20 years will know that it's been British governments that have been already privatizing the National Health Service. There's huge amounts of, you know, healthcare that is done by private firms. It's certainly not going to be an imposition from the United States. And I think what is really happening is that there is just a complete misunderstanding of a deliberate, actually, misunderstanding of the way trade deals work. You know, it will be entirely possible, yes, that the jobs in the NHS that are currently done by, you know, British and European capitalists may also be competed for by big bad American capitalists. But, you know, why is there this assumption that American providers are somehow worse, or that American health companies are somehow more greedy and more evil than their British capitalist cousins? I mean, it's just completely perverse.
There are capitalists for our NHS. Yeah,
like Richard Branson, our beloved Richard Branson, who, you know, earns billions out of our beloved NHS. But, you know,
Trump coming over reveals a lot about what we already knew about the current state of politics in terms of its shallow nature, that we can, you know, that great example that you can forget about the problems, the long-standing problems we have with our own healthcare system, just because you can point the finger and say, but God, isn't it so terrible over in America? We don't want that. I mean, Trump is not a politician that I or anyone around this table subscribe to. We want to see him defeated in an upcoming election. There's some very big issues with his political viewpoints, as there is with our own domestic politics here in Britain. But the whole spectacle of the Trump visit has just shown how, you know, absolutely incapable we are of actually dealing with serious politics. The main opposition to him you have is a bunch of nutters going out on the streets, throwing milkshakes at each other and essentially having a good time and dressing up. I mean, it's really embarrassing. And it's important to also note that the number of protesters were much less than the last time that he came over here. So, you know, in general, people aren't that excited by the state visit, other than the ones who want to get excited by him, who aren't giving forward any kind of positive political opposition to him. So the whole thing is just a bit depressing, I have to say.
You're listening to the Spike podcast. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if you get this podcast on iTunes, why not give us a rating and a review? It really helps new listeners find the show. Dominic Raab, one of the dozens of contenders for the Tory leadership, has been pulled up over an old column in which he criticised feminism. Writing in Politics Home in 2011, he said that feminists were now among the most obnoxious bigots for not recognising that from cradle to the grave, men are getting a raw deal. He's since clarified that while he would not call himself a feminist, he does believe in equality and meritocracy. Ella, do we all have to call ourselves feminists these days?
If you want to be accepted in polite society, it's probably advisable that you do. Because the minute that you disown the F word, you essentially, it's like a black stain on your political career, and you're not going to get the places that you want to go. I mean, in fact, Dominic Raab's article that he wrote in 2011, whilst being a bit OTT, you know, throwing around the word bigger and actually, you know, putting forward quite a wrong-headed viewpoint in relation to men being the victims and sort of going down, not exactly the MRA route, but kind of a men's rights activist's light argument it was. But it had some quite interesting points in relation to challenging the status of the gender pay gap reporting, about raising questions about, you know, this obsession with gender, you know, bar the headline of the bigots. It was a relatively interesting article you could take on, and it was dragged up against him and used as this, you know, this thing that he said that was so utterly, utterly terrible. I mean, nowhere in that article or anywhere else has he said women need to be chained to the kitchen sink and, you know, making sandwiches for their husbands. He's, as with lots of people who have denounced the feminist tag, he's been quite explicit in the fact that he does believe in equality of the sexes. The problem with feminism today, I think, and the reason why, let's remember, as we've said previously on this podcast, lots of women, the majority of women, do not subscribe to it. I mean, polls show that about 30% in around 2017, 2018 subscribed to it. Back in 2016, that was before hashtag MeToo kicked off, the Fawcett Society, and the feminist organisation, found that only 7% of women subscribe to feminists. So, I mean, most of us are like Dominic Raab, don't really like it, think it's going kind of down a bit of an extreme route in terms of continuously portraying women as victims for everything. What's the problem? I mean, it just reveals how much of an elitist and professional set contemporary feminists are. They are the kind of the movers and shakers in society, the journalists, the commentators, the politicians who want to use feminism as a means to give their identities a bit more of a shine.
Yeah.
What it means for the average woman out on the street is nothing.
Tom?
I'm kind of struck by this kind of two contradictory things going on at the same time as well, because on the one hand, as Ella writes in a piece on Spike this week, it has become like a religious test. Are you a feminist? That's your ticket into public life. There was this very strange period in which all pop stars were being asked this question, particularly female pop stars. That's a funny thing. It's not men really getting the heat for this. It's often women. There was a period of time when every interview Beyonce did, she was asked if she was a feminist, because she'd once kind of given a fudge, not quite answer. And so it just went on and on and on until she put that song Flawless out with the quote from the TED talk about why we should all be feminists in it, performed at the VMAs in 2014 with the word feminist behind her, and then it all was forgiven. So you've got this kind of very strange dynamic where people are constantly demanding that people in public life subscribe to feminism. And then at the same time, you also have this weird thing going on in parallel, which is people telling people they're feminists when they're not. So, you know, talking about, as Ella talks about, the fact that most women in the UK and America don't identify as feminists, and people say, well, if you agree with these points, then you are a feminist. And my favourite example, I think she was actually talking about men here, but Emma Watson, who had just recently been named UN Women's Goodwill Ambassador in 2015. She was doing this Q&A and she said, if you stand for equality, then you're a feminist. Sorry to tell you, you're a feminist. So there is this kind of slight weird thing going on where on the one hand, you know, you must abide by this idea and this set of principles, but at the same time, it's been so defined down, you know, so turned into something which can apparently both include Julie Bindle and Beyonce.
Yeah.
So kind of just turned into this very vague brand that almost anyone can jump on board of it. And I think the way in which you see the marriage of feminism and celebrity in particular, I think it says less about how popular it is or how popular it might be, but how thin and kind of meaningless it's become. It's a pose rather than a set of positions, it feels like.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's making me think of the "This is what a feminist looks like" t-shirt that was worn by all of the, you know, all of the party leaders several years ago, apart from David Cameron. And then it was discovered that actually the t-shirt was being, you know, stitched up by women in the developing world for absolute pittance.
Yeah. That happened again quite recently with Holly Willoughby and the members of the Spice Girls wearing girl power t-shirts that were being produced by Bangladeshi women who had tried to go on strike and had been quashed and were being paid pennies. So, I mean, as that kind of side of the argument is a little bit irritating, but it does show that actually in terms of Western feminism, it really isn't political in any sense, even though it's really sort of, you know, they march and parliament holds meetings about feminism, and this gets put forward at this very sort of strident radical thing. In fact, if you look at what it actually stands for, I mean, the headline topics of feminism today are, for example, period poverty, which is a kind of a bizarre paternalistic approach to working class women and their access to sanitary pads. It's just a really strange thing, the obsession with period poverty. FGM, which is, you know, not only sort of encourages racial profiling in the UK, but is also a massive panic on the behalf of Western white women. And being nice to women in general. That's the other kind of headline campaign. Yeah. Just be nice to women, be softer, be more feminine. Saying to men, you know, this is why I wrote in my article, I found it so infinitely weird, this desire for men to become feminists.
Creepiest thing in the world.
It's really, it's creepy, because the main narrative behind contemporary feminism is for men to sit down, shut up, you know, lean out so women can lean in. And anyone who's going to engage in that kind of self-deprecating, you know, self flagellation type of politics is just surely making yourself into a doormat. Yeah. It's sort of kind of really gross, and I don't want to be around any guy that has that little self-respect.
Well, I'll take a feminist off my Tinder profile.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is actually a big list. There's a website you can go to see the male feminists of Tinder. It's quite interesting. But let's let's not forget that, you know, there's a lot of criticism, and I have a lot of criticism for feminism of the past. It's not like, you know, in the 60s and 70s everything was great, but it did used to be radical.
Yeah.
And it did used to stand for some radical things. And there are still some things, some radical demands that women need to make in 2019, whether that be around abortion rights or childcare, or even in some cases, pay and wages and, you know, access to society's resources. We could be making some big and radical arguments for women's liberation. But what needs to happen, I think, is to stop fussing around this question of feminism, which essentially has just become like a designer label. You know, you wear it if you're in the right set.
I think that we still have this kind of slight problem with the fact that we have this confusing kind of language around it, because, again, I wouldn't call myself a feminist, obviously, but I don't have necessarily a problem with it if people are using it as just another word for women's liberation politics. But that's not what people are doing. You know, there is nothing to do with liberation whatsoever about feminism today. It's synonymous, largely speaking, with censorship, the idea that you need to censor, you know, adverts, Twitter, whatever it is, to protect women's self-esteem because they're so fragile. It's increasingly obsessed with effectively acknowledging and all kind of reckoning with the fact that women are victims in almost all circumstances, which is the entire opposite of a liberationary politics about removing barriers and freedom and all the rest of it. And also, it's, as with so many other areas of identity politics, it's really narcissistic, because the campaigns are so much about how I'm treated or how I'm spoken about or how this. It often provides a lot of license to often very prominent and privileged people to talk about themselves, which is why it plays really well in Teen Vogue, which is why, you know, celebrities and pop stars can get on board with it, and which is why it's attractive to a lot of women of very privileged backgrounds who now have a means through which to say people should feel sorry for them. I mean, that, without being too crass about it, the idea that feminism has anything to do with women's liberation really anymore, certainly not in its mainstream form, it doesn't.
You're listening to the Spiked podcast. Spiked has no subscriptions and no paywalls. All of our content is free. We rely on the generosity of our listeners and readers to keep us going and growing. For those of you who already donate to Spiked, we can't thank you enough. It really means a lot to all of us. If you haven't already, then why not consider giving Spiked a donation? You can make a one-off payment or give monthly by going to spiked-online.com. Gareth Roberts, an award-winning Doctor Who writer, has been sacked by BBC Books for his views on trans issues. Roberts was due to contribute to an upcoming Doctor Who anthology, but a fellow contributor objected to his presence and complained to the publisher. She later celebrated his sacking by tweeting that transphobic views have no place in the Whoniverse, both in and outside the stories. Tom, do you want to tell us a bit more about this case?
Yeah, so it's a really striking case. So Gareth Roberts, as you were saying, is this Doctor Who writer. He's written 6 episodes of the kind of Revive series, numerous kind of TV and print spin-offs. And so he was writing as part of this new collection. He'd actually written it. It had already been commissioned and sent in, and I imagine kind of rubber stamped. But then this campaign on social media started to kick off, led, as you say, by this other contributor who is, from what I read in Tim Dawson's great write-up of this in Spike this week, is a far more lesser-known author, it has to say, and whose latest book apparently is about, quote, dragons and toxic masculinity. So it tells you something about where she's coming from in relation to all this stuff. And very quickly they caved. And what I think was really striking about it was the quote that they gave Tim for his piece, which says that comments made by the author on social media using offensive language about the transgender community have caused upset to Doctor Who fans and conflict with our values as a publisher. So what are those values exactly, I think, is the question. So Gareth Roberts, he's a gay man, incidentally. He's used the word trannies once, at least, on Twitter, which he claims is somewhat of a generational thing, which is one point. Also, as he spells out in this Medium post, which is also a kind of really statement about it, he just says that he just doesn't happen to believe that you can change your biological sex. He doesn't think women's spaces should be rearranged on the basis of men being able to become women, etc. And he doesn't think anyone's views should be imposed upon him. And it's worth pointing out that whatever the supposed values of Ebury Publishing are, that is the mainstream view.
Yeah.
And what's one of the things that I think it's important to take away from this story is the fact that someone has effectively been sacked for expressing a view which had nothing to do with the work he was doing. This was not a transgender story. This was not touching any of these issues whatsoever. For expressing a view that the majority of people in this country hold. And I think that's taken us down a pretty dangerous route, and yet at the same time felt so familiar as well.
Well, yeah, it felt familiar because there have been so many cases like this. I mean, actually, some even more worrying cases where the police have been involved with people expressing a view that is critical of, you know, transgender ideology, that basically states that there is a difference between men and women. I mean, we talked about on the podcast before the man who, you know, tweeted a sort of anti-trans limerick and who had a phone call from the police. You know, there was an old age pensioner, feminist blogger who had a visit from the police. There have even been people put in cells overnight for, you know, basically criticizing transgender ideology.
Yeah, I mean, usually these clampdowns come from on high. So, you know, you have like blasphemy laws, which means that society hasn't accepted, but is enforced that you're not allowed to say certain things. This is a type of censorship that's really just come out of thin air. I mean, in the last decade only, we sort of start to see the really ramping up of clampdowns on this. And, you know, not necessarily a politician has passed a law to say that it's illegal to say these things, and yet people are being censored for it. I mean, the interesting thing, if I can use the word interesting, about the case of Gareth Roberts is that he's gay himself. And there's a tension within the LGBT community in which gay men who are drag artists, who have been drag artists for decades, are now being accused of transphobia for dressing up like women, because it's the trans community, or some members of the trans community who are sort of militant campaigners, argue that this is essentially ridiculing the experience of a trans person. And similarly, I mean, the reason why he was pinned for using the word trannies is because that's meant to be transphobic, even though it's something that members of the LGBT community have used to self-identify themselves with for years. So it's like a complete rewriting of language, actually, in a way that is really quite frightening.
Well, he gives the example of queer, and the way that, you know, he and his friends used to call themselves queer, and now, you know, queer has actually become an accepted kind of umbrella term for LGBT issues.
I mean, the other aspect of this that's interesting is because that we're dealing in the realms of fiction, you know, the Hooniverse. I'm not a fan of Doctor Who, but I can't imagine that it would matter massively to a storyline whether or not one of the writers had a certain political viewpoint or personal viewpoint. And we've seen this in different cases in relation to differentiating between artists and their work, you know, whether a writer's personality should affect the way and the kind of the pieces that they put forward. And that distinction has just completely gone out here in relation to that. There's nothing even to prove that the story that Gareth wrote had anything to do with this political dispute, had anything to do with gender. And even if it did, I mean, the idea is that you can't differentiate, you can't hold a personal viewpoint. And it is a very personal viewpoint. And the idea that you would enforce the kind of clamp down on that very personal thing of what you believe in, especially in relation to as a member of that LGBT community, is a bit mad.
It is really strange. And I think one of the things that's quite striking about it is that fact that this was a privately held view, which he expressed in public, but everyone's entitled to express their opinion. And it had nothing to do with the work that he was doing, because the upshot of all of this is that he effectively won't be allowed to work. This is an area in which it seems like he's really made his name. It's probably something which he's quite rely on for income. And because of a view he happens to hold completely separate to his professional life, he's not allowed to work now. I mean, you know, you don't want to get too over the top about this, but you do start thinking about the kind of Hollywood blacklist and McCarthyism. You know, is this going to be the kind of litmus test for anyone who wants to work in a nice, modern, you know, publishing business? Are you, or have you ever been a transphobe? You know, that is really, really quite strange, really, really quite sinister. And again, I think particularly on the trans issue, because it does in so many ways, and the kind of claims that are surrounding it, you know, are trans women, and can you change your biological sex and all the rest of it, is the fact that it's increasingly going to make people, particularly work in certain sectors, just have to either completely shut up or say things that they know to be false or they feel very strongly to be false in order to just operate like a normal human being. That's a really, really unhealthy society. So however much people want to split hairs on this question, how much it might have upset the readers, I don't think most of them would ever have known how much it might make the other contributors feel uncomfortable. That's the sort of world that we're edging towards if these things carry on.
Thank you for listening to the Spike podcast. We'll be back next week. And in the meantime, for more great Spike content or to make a donation, just visit spiked-online.com.